This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين أما بعد فنسأل الله تعالى أن يغفر لنا ذنوبنا ويكفر عنا سيئاتنا نسأله بعلم نافع ورزق واسع وعليه نتوكل وإليه المصير ولا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم وصلى الله على نبينا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. We begin by praising Allah. We praise Him. We seek His help, forgiveness, and guidance. We send peace and prayers on His final message, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We ask Allah for useful knowledge and understanding, that which is beneficial and wide sustenance. We are utterly dependent on Him. And to Him is our return and our goal. Brothers and sisters, I can't see any at the moment, but for completion, Salaamu Alaikum wa Rahmatullah. Peace and mercy of Allah be with you. Continuing with our topic of Sharh Arba'een, the deep explanation of the 40 hadith of An-Nawawi. Last two sessions, we concentrated more of an introduction. First session was about the issue of hadith and sunnah, definition, a little bit about where it fits, its evidence in regards to the Quran, and how important it is. And something on about the historical analysis of hadith. Then last time we looked more at the issue of as-siha sitta, as they are known as, the six authentic books, which I explained last time is not the best title for those books that are included in that, but perhaps as should be called ad-dawaween as-sitta fi hadith, or fil hadith. Of a hadith al-Nabawiyyah, which is books on hadith, because as I explained last time, what they were, who were the ones who put them together, etc. We discussed that last time. We mentioned something about the famous book Mishkat al-Masabih also. So I want to move on now. I want to say something about this particular book that we're going to be going through and the ahadith that are compiled in it. Of course, it's compiled by an imam, Imam Nawawi. Imam Nawawi, or Yahya ibn Sharaf is his name. Abu Zakaria, sometimes they call him with this kunya. Abu Zakaria, even though he has this kunya, the father of Zakaria, he actually didn't have any children called Zakaria. Actually, he didn't have any children because he wasn't married. He never got married. So sometimes in Arab culture, people are given a kunya, just like a nickname, laqab. I don't know why he was given the name Abu Zakaria, but it is mentioned. You also find in some places it's mentioned as Yahya ibn Sharaf. Muhiddin was not part of his name. Some ulama and some people and followers called him Muhiddin. It's said in some of the seerah writings, his seerah writing. Now we're talking about seerah of An-Nawawi. When I say seerah now, or we could say tarjama has the same meaning as seerah, so we don't get confused. It is the biographies And his biography, it's mentioned that some say that he didn't like the title of Muhyiddin. It's more of a title, the one who revived the religion, of course given by others who saw the great value of Imam Nawawi and his teachings and his fiqh and his writings. And that's why that title sometimes there, although it's not part of his name. But Nawawi, as with many and majority of the scholars, you find it links back to generally where they are born or what tribes they come from. And it's said that Nawah is a village just outside Damascus. So he was in the Sham area, although he travelled around, but that was his place. In contrast to many ulama, Imam Nawawi doesn't come from a line of scholars. He hasn't got in his parents, grandparents, you know, grandfathers, etc., lineage of scholars, in contrast to many others. And he was of a humble background, and he's known for being Zahid. Zahid means that of meager means. His main job after studying, and he was very clever, after studying Islam, and his main focus beyond Quran and Hadith was Shafi'i fiqh. He's Shafi'i. Shafi'i fiqh. He studied and was a master in it. And he taught it as well in Damascus, in the various schools that were set up where he studied himself. So, he was, it said, the born in 631 Hijri and died in 676. So he died young, he died only 44 years of age. And like he explains, one of his little books that I've, some of these books I've got to bring it with me, I think. It's actually part of an introduction to his most famous encyclopedia, Al-Majmu'a, which is his real encyclopedia in Shafi'i fiqh, fi sharh al-Muhadhab li-Shirazi. Shirazi came hundreds of years before him, and he wrote Al-Muhadhab, which is like a summary, edited version of Shafi'i fiqh. So Imam Nawawi came and he did Al-Majmu' based on that, but with his greater detail, Quran, Sunnah, giving the evidences. And Imam Nawawi, his work Al-Majmu', which he didn't complete actually, he died before he completed it. He completed only, they say, 9 volumes or so of this work. He asked one of his famous students, Ibn al-Attar, to complete the work after him. Must have been in his final illness that he's asked him to complete it, but he was unable to do that. Taqiyuddin As-Subki, who came sometime after, As-Subki himself is a great scholar in Shafi'i fiqh, he added a couple of volumes to it, but later on, I think probably in the 1900s, some people mention it, another scholar added some more volumes, although some people criticize that. But anyway, he himself has 9 volumes called Al-Majmu'a. When you hear about Al-Majmu'a, then that is one of the most famous works of Imam An-Nawawi. It has the same caliber, as other ulama say, on the same pedestal of the work by Ibn Qudama. Ibn Qudama is Hanbali. Ibn Qudama wrote a similar work in Hanbali fiqh called Al-Mughni fi sharh al-Mukhtasar al-Khiraqi. Mukhtasar of Khiraqi, who was a Hanbali scholar, was again written before Mukhtasar, meaning a summarizing of the Hanbali fiqh. Then Ibn Qudama comes and he builds on that, and his work is of some volumes. Al-Mughni, which Al-Majmu' I haven't had a chance to study. Al-Mughni I've been studying for some years now in Hanbali fiqh. But the good thing about these, both these works, is Imam al-Nawawi and Ibn Qudama, the Hanbali, they didn't stick just to blindly to their madhab. But especially Ibn Qudama, and it's mentioned that al-Nawawi does, Ibn Qudama, I've studied it for some years myself, so I know he does. They mention the opinions of the other ulama from the madhahib. Yeah. So in Al-Mughni, for example, Ibn Qudama will mention on issues the opinion of Abu Hanifa, yeah, of Shafi'i, the various opinions transmitted of Ahmad ibn Hanbal, and he's a Hanbali himself. Yeah. Or he'll mention opinions not just of that, but opinions where there's difference of opinion of the Sahaba. He's especially very foremost in mentioning what Ibn al-Mundhir says. Ibn al-Mundhir, some said he was Shafi'i, but actually he wasn't. He was an independent, mujtahid and scholar. Aside from, and that's why I always say, there was more than four scholars. There wasn't just Abu Hanifa and Imam Malik and Shafi'i and Ahmad ibn Hanbal, of course. There was many, but their students made their madhahib become very popular. Historically, if you go back. So you find Ibn Qudama, for example, he'll mention the opinion of Abu Thawl, Ibn al-Mundhir, al-Awza'i, yeah, others, aside from Shafi'i, Abu Hanifa, his two most famous, as they're known as Sahiban, his two most famous students of Abu Hanifa, who are? Two most famous students of Abu Hanifa are?
Abu Yusuf.
Yeah, Abu Yusuf, Qadi Abu Yusuf, the judge. Who's the other one? Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Shaybani, basically. Yeah, al-Shaybani. Abu al-Hasan. Muhammad ibn al-Hasan al-Shaybani. Maybe I had a mental block myself. Muhammad ibn al-Hasan al-Shaybani and Abu Yusuf. There are these two most famous students and the most famous transmitters of the Hanafi madhab. Yeah, they were immediate students. So Ibn Qudama in the Hanbali fiqh, in his book Al-Mughni, that's his approach. He'll go back to Quran and Sunnah and he'll actually come outside the madhab where he feels, well, I disagree with this and I think this is the right opinion. And Nawawi is similar in that regard in Al-Majmu'ah. Similar method and way. Really following it off the leaders of the madhahib. Imam Shafiq, for example, and Abu Hanifa, all of them said, this is an opinion I have. If you find a hadith which is authentic that counters my opinion, then that is my madhab. So this is the way that these great scholars followed. Imam Nawawi is known famously after Imam Shafi'i. He's coming, of course, over 400 years after Imam Shafi'i. Imam Shafi'i died in 205 Hijra. When I talk about Hijra, then you need to add to it about 620 odd years to get AD. I'll leave that to you. I'm not going to give you both. Myself, it's easier to work in Hijra. It gives me a better idea of how far they are from the time of Rasulullah, from the Hijra. Okay? But that's for you, a simple equation, add 620 or whatever to get the idea. So Imam Nawawi, you're talking about 7th century Hijra, okay? He and before him, a few hundred years before him, was Ar-Rafi'i. And Rafi'i was very famous. He made the Shafi'i madhab so popular. So they say Rafi'i, it was the Shafi'i of his time. Yeah. Rafi'i is so famous because of the standing he had and how much he spread Shafi'i madhab as a great scholar. So the two people, when they say The two people of Abu Hanifa were Abu Yusuf and Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Shaybani. They say the two people of Imam Shafi'i, although they're not his direct students now, they're coming hundreds of years later, are Rafi'i and An-Nawawi. Alright? Al-Rafi'i and Nawawi. As somebody said hundreds of years back, the people are now, they must have been surrounded by Shafi'iyya, this person who said this, people are now all Rafi'is, or Nabawis, rather than being Nabawis. Yeah, rather than being Nabawi, meaning they're not even following the Prophet, they just follow the opinions of Shafi'i and Rafi'i. Nabawi and Rafi'i. But anyway, that's just to say that's how famous they became in Shafi'i Madhab, Imam Nawawi. So, Imam Nawawi, as I said, was Imam Nawawi was well known to be Zahid, as I said, of meager means. His income was, some say, he had income from his teaching students for some years, and then he even stopped that, and his father used to provide. It's not very clear, to be honest, as to, he must have had some sort of income, otherwise he wouldn't be able to survive. Yeah. So sometimes people exaggerate things and make it out as though somebody had nothing. It's impossible for him to live like that, because he's not known for begging of other people and taking from his students. He's well known for serving, as many ulama and scholars have always done, in serving the students, actually. Serving the students. In contrast to what I've seen of some imams and ulama of present day, and they have their students running around. I've seen maulanas and maulvis, once they get work, they get them washing their socks and taking their clothes and bringing them shopping and stuff like that. I've always disliked that. May Allah save us from that. But the real scholars, great scholars, they never had this kind of thing. They actually serve them. So they'll serve them tea or, not tea at that time, but if they were in the present time, they'd be serving them tea, looking after the needs of their students, yeah? Servicing them in khidmah to them. And that was Nawawi as well, which fits in line with what he wrote. Which is being printed a separate book. It'd be nice to have it translated in English, but I studied it in Arabic a couple of times, and each time I look at it, I benefit from it. But it's a short thing taken from his introduction to Al-Majmu'. In his introduction is something he entitles under a chapter, Adab Al-Mu'allim Wal-Muta'allim, the etiquettes of the teacher and the student. The etiquette of the teacher and the student. And most of it, it's beautiful, yeah, beautiful. Firstly, reminding the teacher and the student about the right intention. Teacher and the student about the right intention for studying. Why are you doing it? Yeah, to focus and also to keep the intention purely for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which will give the benefit, otherwise there'll be no benefit. Yeah, or minimal benefit. If you're doing it to show off to people, yeah, if you're doing it for worldly gains, then in the end, there'll be no khulus in it, no good intention, and therefore understanding of the deen especially is in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So khulus, which only He knows, will give you that reaping rewards and the fruits. Yeah. So, in the area of the etiquettes, some of the etiquettes of the teacher, he talks about how they deal with the students, how to be forgiving and gentle with the students, how to encourage the students, how to be full of humility and not arrogant with the students, etc. He goes through a whole list of things. And how... And this has not only been taught by Nawawi, this has been taught by others as well. From the student's side, how respect is given to the knowledge. Imam Bukhari, for example, the governor in his later life, requested him to come and teach his sons in the palace. Imam Bukhari refused. He said, because knowledge, you need to travel to gain knowledge, not Mike. The knowledge doesn't come to you. And this is very important for us as students to realize. And he's practiced today. I mean, personally, I've been traveling for 20 plus years on a weekly basis almost, from here for a couple of hours to travel to Leeds for my sheikh. I've traveled in my holidays, gone abroad, yeah, to gain a knowledge and understanding of the deen. I know there's some brothers and sisters here, forget me traveling 2 hours, from Manchester area, who've been going to Sheikh Akram Nadwi for quite a few years now, and they go down by car, that's traveling down to London or Cambridge or Oxford they've been doing for many years on a weekly basis, taking out a whole Sunday away from their work or families or play. Yeah, that's the kind of sacrifice that's needed when you show respect for that knowledge. Only with that is then, because if you have a real desire for it, real desire with khulus, with good intention, then it'll come. It'll come there. But if you just see it as, ah, well, I got time today, there's no football match on, right? I got nothing better to do, all right? Or I'm old and decrepit now, I might as well go to the mosque and listen to another talk. If that's the attitude, well, you, as they say in English, you reap what you sow. And the same idea here. Yeah. The idea is what we put in, how much desire, for what purpose as well? What is the qasd? What is the intention? Yeah. If it is to, it must always be to grow closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. To teach is to fulfill a responsibility to Allah, yeah, which Allah and His Messenger put on those of us who learn to give to others. Yeah. And to learn is, again, the idea, first and foremost, is that I understand my deen more and I come close to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, so I can be a better servant to Allah. That must be the purpose, primarily, to become a better practicing Muslim. So some of the etiquettes he mentions for the students and the teacher about coming in nice dress, about smelling nice as coming to the mosque, you know, but he stresses especially on the teachers because they're setting the example, but also for the students as well, not just to come willy-nilly, not to be having their own discussion. Nowadays it would be not to be sitting on the mobile phone, wouldn't it? Yeah. Or having a private discussion when the teacher is actually teaching. And the way of asking questions, yeah, with the etiquette and respect, even though you may be disagreeing with the teacher, he says. But how you disagree, yeah, is and how you put your question, there's an etiquette to it, an adab to it. One or two of the things which I disagree with Imam Nawawi, with the great respect for him, is what he wrote in his etiquettes, and others. I'm not the first one to disagree with him. I don't put myself on a pedestal up there to say I disagree with him because I'm so great. No, others have disagreed with that as well. But it's interesting that he mentions them, which fits with the fact that he didn't get married and he died at 44 without being married and having. So, under the etiquettes of a student, he quotes others as well as himself, quotes not from the Prophet, but from others, as saying, the one who gets married, it's as though he's gone to the sea. And the sea for the Arabs, you know, is like going to disaster and destruction, as I mentioned to you before in the seerah. Right? And the one then who has children, well, it's as though he's been broken. So he's doing it, he's saying, well, if you get married and have children, in other words, it's going to hinder your progress in gaining knowledge and in your studies. So I can see where he's coming from one side, but it is exaggerated too much, almost against the sunnah of Rasulullah, who made it mustahab at least when he said, An-nikahu min sunnati fa man raghiba an sunnati falaysa minni. Nikah is from my sunnah. Yeah, whoever runs away from it or shuns it, they're not from amongst me. I don't still say that's the reason. Ulama came after. They give various ideas of why we didn't get married. Allahu alam. But we don't say he was trying to avoid the sunnah of Rasulullah. That's for sure. That's for sure. Some say perhaps one of the only sunnahs and Nawawi didn't do in his life was getting married. How do you know? How do you know? You know all the sunnahs he performed? That's exaggerating. Okay? That's going too far. Putting it on such a high pedestal that he did all the other sunnahs. Yeah? Nabawiyah, except he didn't get married. Well, no, we don't say that. But we say he didn't do that sunnah. For whatever reasons. And sometimes you can be preoccupied in studying and teaching that you don't have actually time in that period of time. I don't believe that he decided that I'm never going to get married. It just so happened. He died at 44. Some people get married even after that, don't they? Yeah. So that's how we see it. Although his statements in the etiquettes of a student are a bit gone a bit too far. And if we apply them to our context today, and even in the context of that time, then there's an encouragement by the Prophet ﷺ actually in the hadith to get married, isn't there? Ya ma'ashra shabab, or young people, whoever from amongst you is able to get married, they should get married. Rasulullah ﷺ saying it. Yeah, and he didn't put in there, Rasulullah ﷺ didn't put in that a statement saying, unless you're studying, then you don't need to. Didn't say that. Didn't say that. That's why other ulama and scholars actually said, for a young person, and they talked, most of the time they're talking about young men. Partly because young women for them are out of the equation of studies. This is a cultural thing, which I disagree with again. Okay? The idea of studying the deen is for men and women. So young men and young women. So when they're writing, they're talking about young men. So the guy, the man's going to be occupied with his wife. Well, hang on. What about if the young woman wants to study and she's going to be occupied with the husband? Yeah. So they don't mention that. They always talk about the man being preoccupied with the wife. So much so, he quotes, and you know, in the end, I'll say it in a gentle way, but there's no shyness when you're studying these works and what he says. He quotes others and himself saying, the man who falls between the thighs of his wife, from him, knowledge will disappear and dissipate. He'll lose it all. Meaning, don't get involved in marital life. That's what he's talking about. And he quotes others mentioning this kind of statement again. And actually, it may be okay for some. Maybe that way for some. Male or female, actually, I would say. But for others, actually getting married takes their mind off what's going on around them. Don't you think people have got hormones when they're young people in their, you know, teens and 20s? Allah put those desires in the male and the female. So if you're not fulfilling those desires, I would also go the other way and say that you're going to find it very difficult to focus on studying. True? And that's why other scholars exactly argued that. As I'm arguing and saying, I disagree with the great Imam An-Nawawi on this issue. On this issue. Personally, I'll give my own example. If I was in my 20s and I couldn't carry on studying till the 40s without getting married and fulfilling that which Allah put in me as a natural desire, I'm talking about myself. And I think many of you might feel the same. But there are always exceptions to the rule. And then you put in today's society and where we are and what we're surrounded by. That's a completely different factor. And imagine now that compared to the society at the time of Imam Nawawi living in Damascus in the 7th century Hijra in the Muslim world. And so, so when you read these works, you have to put all that in place. I don't believe Imam An-Nawawi would have said that now in present day society. No chance. So you give the scholar the context of the time and place. So you give him an uzr. Yeah, as an excuse for what they're saying. Because they're doing it in their context and time. Yeah. Even though scholars of that time would still disagree with him, because Sahaba, the Prophet ﷺ, is sending him a different way. They had desires at their time in Medinan society, and the Prophet was encouraging them and their scholars which of the scholars of the Sahaba, and they were greater scholars than the great man Imam Nawawi, yeah? They all got married and had children. Yeah. So that didn't hinder them, did it? So the idea of some of them saying, oh, all the knowledge will disappear and all this, well, how come it didn't happen with the Sahaba and the Tabi'in who came after them? So these arguments, this is some of the stuff in there. I'm just mentioning to you that when you read it, then you read those things. Don't take everything in. Be critical when you study. Be critical. And all ulama and scholars who taught students, they want their students to be critical, to think. To think. Yeah. And those are the best students, who are thinking students, who questioning students. Questioning, as he says as well, and as I was taught, questioning is so important. Don't be shy from questioning. Yeah? Shyness, like the Prophet, like it said, Mujahid said it, that two things which prevent a person from learning are shyness, extreme shyness. What's the other one?
Arrogance.
Arrogance. Extreme shyness. So that's why Ummul Mu'mineen Aisha radiallahu anha, she says, "Ni'mu nisa nisa il ansar." The best of women were the women of the Ansar. Their shyness didn't prevent them asking questions about the deen. Because they'll just come out with it. Ya Rasulullah, I'm on menzies, what do I... Everybody's sitting around. Yeah? Or a woman comes and she says, Ya Rasulullah, and Ummul Mu'mineen Aisha sitting there, some of the Sahaba are there. So this woman comes in, this is an authentic hadith, she says, my husband's private part, it's a bit like this hanging handkerchief. The Sahaba are all embarrassed like this, but she just comes out with it. Because she was trying to get separation from him, she's trying to say he's impotent. He's not able to... So he just came out with it in front of everybody. Prophet ﷺ said, how dare you say that? And he's saying, you know, go out and... No, he just answered the questions and dealt with it. Anyway, the idea of extreme shyness is not having good etiquette. Asking the question, you can ask with good etiquette. Extreme shy, because when you ask a question, it clarifies for others as well, and it clarifies for you what you may be confused with, and you go away with the same confusion and you stay with it because you never asked. You never asked. And arrogance is quite clear, because arrogance means, well, I know everything, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I don't need to ask him. You see what I'm saying? So arrogance, it puts a block in the way straight away anyway. I don't need to learn of anybody, I can do it all myself. So in line with that, this is also something I learned, even though the Prophet ﷺ said, بَلِّغُوا أَنِّي وَلَوْ آيَةً, transmit from me even if it's one ayah. So if you learn something and you're sure about it, then learning and teaching can take place simultaneously. Why do I say that? Because I was involved in dawah work in Islamic organizations, in teaching and spreading Islam, Muslim and non-Muslim, in communities with young people and others, since the early 80s, okay? And I was learning as I was going along from various teachers along the way. Then, a decade in the 90s especially, this started, some of the young people went away and started in, and went away abroad, etc., quite rightly, to study deen, and went to study it from shuyukh and from scholars, yeah? But some of them, not all of them, when they came back, they started criticizing those who were doing da'wah work. I'll tell you, in the 80s, there were very few people giving talks in English in universities and schools. Me and a few others were few and far between. It was like an enigma. People looked, oh my God, he's speaking English. He's explaining Islam in English. Yeah? So it was a... Now it's totally changed, but I'm talking about the 80s. It was a time when, you know, somebody spoke in English, you'd get the guy with the orange hat on his head speaking with a Pakistani accent. Yeah, watch Eid. Ah, well, Eid is just like Christmas. Yeah, and we used to go like this, cringe and try and hide and say, oh, please, he's representing us on the TV. Yeah, Council of Mosques, mentioning no names. So that's the kind of thing you generally had, okay? So when somebody spoke English like me, and about Islam or about any, it was like a shock to the system for people. Anyway, my point was, some people came back, young people, again, they'd learnt the basics after a few years. They hadn't become shuyukh and scholars, but because it hadn't really, wisdom comes with time and experience of life. So some of them started pointing the finger and saying to other young people, don't take Islam for these people. They haven't studied Islam at the feet of scholars. They just, you know, so don't listen to what. So I spoke to some of them at the time and said, this is ridiculous. It is true, nevertheless, like An-Nawawi says and others, and many said it, be careful. Deen is the most important thing for us, isn't it? It decides our hereafter. No wonder they said, be careful who you take it from. Why do I say it now? Number one, Google. Be careful where you get your information from. Not to say that everything on Google is rubbish, but are you qualified to be able to decipher that this what it's saying and is correct and this is rubbish? Or which site is it and which scholar is it? Yeah, so be careful. Be careful where you take it. Be careful, as Imam Nawawi says, taking deen from people who just have studied deen from books without access to scholars. Yeah, without access to scholars. Now, that is not an absolute by any means. It's not an absolute, because you can learn a lot from books. Yeah. I don't say, and as I mentioned many times to publicly, I don't advise people generally to go and study Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. Why not? Because it needs an explanation, that's why. But if I'm studying, or I encourage you to study the tafsir of Ibn Kathir, for example. So if you're having a study circle and you access Ibn Kathir's tafsir, he's given you the explanation there. And especially if it's in the English language. So now you can use that to run a study circle, because you have a reference point. It is from the book, but the explanation has been given by Ibn Kathir in the book. Where you don't understand something, even in that explanation, then you leave off that and say, I need to check. So it is not an absolute that you can't go to the books and reference and teach from that. You can. Yeah, you can. But when you're talking about serious study in depth, then people who study just from the books, and I've seen those people as well over the years, by the way, they have no reference or minimal reference to scholars, right? They tend to go into deviation, yeah, because they're always thinking it with their own. They don't have any to throw back off or to check with or reference with or to discuss with their ideas, yeah? So there's a danger with it, yeah? Hence a reference to somebody who's been with scholars, and then they're transmitting and teaching others, and they have, this has always been the way, yeah? Study and teach. You study and teach, you don't just teach. So scholars themselves are in a process of learning, and one of the humility, an important humility of scholars, is they must always be learning. When a scholar decides, that's it, I've done with the books, I know everything, he goes back to level one, in my opinion. Yeah? So you never stop learning and studying. So that's an important thing, again, which Imam Nawawi mentions in this booklet. There are many other beautiful things in this adab about questioning. Of course, questioning is another way of realizing that people are understanding who's sitting in the audience. And I've mentioned it lots of times, I mention it again. My classes, there may be some that I've taken in the past, are discussion classes. We all get together, we have a good discussion, and we deliberate on something. These are not those classes. You know that. I'm not saying you don't ask questions, of course you do. But in these type of classes, when I'm teaching something in depth, which is not for the average Joe public out there, actually majority of the people from our community, this will go right over their heads. True? I'm telling you it will. They're saying, what is Yon about? The last two sessions we had, majority of the public out there are saying, oh, it's too detailed for me, too deep for me. Yeah. When I started Fikhu Sira, I remember in the first session or two, we had quite a big turnout, young people, everybody, the hustle and bustle, thought I'd be telling a nice story, like Jackanory, so any age group can come and it'll be nice and rosy and everything and easy. So as soon as I did the first session, after the second, third session, most of them disappeared and never came back again. And I felt for them, but I said that this was going to be deep and it was going to be Fikhu Sira, and it was going to be more scholarly level. Yeah? So that's why even for this, when publicized, I said, not for under 15, 16 year olds. They're going to have something, ability to be able to grasp what we're actually saying. And in that, therefore, is, as I say to you again, is note-making. Note-making. Ulama of the past, we talked about writing in the first session of this. And this idea that people didn't write is nonsensical. Yeah? Some people had masterful memories, no doubt. The majority of people were writing. Yeah? Majority of people were writing from the scholars. And I think the scholars who are teaching, if they found people turning up session after session and actually not writing anything or not taking it in, they'd have something to say about it. So, in the way of encouragement. So I encourage that you do write things, yeah, because they're an important thing. And students were always encouraged, and one of the things Imam Nawawi mentions is about revising your work. Revising your work. You'll be shocked at the shelves of books of my handwriting that I've got over the years, and you'll be also shocked how many times I've gone through tried to revise, because you know I haven't got a memory unless I revise my work. So in other words, it's hard work. Revising your work is crucial. Editing it, re-editing it, because what you learned from 10 years on is not what knowledge you had. Now I look at my works and my work writings from 20 years ago and I think, oh my God, what level was I then? Look what I'm writing. Yeah, sometimes it's nonsense. Yeah, other times it's very shallow. So you can add to it, you see. So that revision. And reading books again. My colleagues, including students from the students in Islamic knowledge from the classes from where I've attended, they've always often asked, how do you read? Do you do scan reading? Yeah. And that's in Arabic or English. And I said, no, not even in English. I've never been a scan reader. I don't do scan reading. I can't. I read to study. And in fact, any book I read, unless it was Count Dracula, Bram Stoker, I didn't make notes on that one. But any, which I read in my teens. Any other book, generally I read, I make notes. That's how I study. I don't do scan reading. I find it a waste of time. And then reading a book second and third time, because it's so important. And most of that we learn from the Quran. You can go over the Quran is the par excellence example of that, isn't it? Because you can go back to the same ayah again and again and again, different times in your life, and it'll still give you something which you didn't get before. So again, these are some hints and clues about studying, and most of it is about being serious, of course. Are we serious? Which reminds me, another thing over the years, I've come across students, us basically, Muslims. A number of people have said, I wish I knew Arabic language. Or I wish I knew Tajweed. I wish I studied this. I wish I had a circle to go. And these are wishes of fools, because one of the most important things, if you are serious, that the wishes have got to change into actual plan. And the plan has to be executed. That requires discipline. Discipline. So very few people I found over the years all around me, in the Islamic work actually, in Islamic Dawah, who were serious about studying. Serious about getting a greater understanding. And that's very important if you want to go that way. Nevertheless, with something like Sharh al-Arba'in al-Nawawiyya, a deep analysis of the ahadith, there'll be benefit in a spiritual sense. As we go through the ahadith, when we get to them, you'll find that even if you're not, I don't want to put you off because you're thinking, well, I'm not that serious a student to become a scholar. It's not just for scholars to come here that you want to be a scholar. You will gain benefit from it. Yeah. Inshallah, there'll be, of course, because in the first and foremost, there are statements of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Yeah. So you will gain benefit, spiritual benefit, benefit of understanding and things, inshallah, from those things. Yeah. Just as a person, with the intention of growing closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and becoming a better Muslim. So it's not to put you off saying all these things. And I don't need to be thinking, well, everything he said, I don't fit any of that category. So it's not because I don't want lack of numbers, but I don't want to put you off. I encourage you instead. Yeah. I hope I've encouraged you instead. So that next time we have a Tuesday circle, there's three people sitting there in this session, I'll know whether I've given the wrong end of the stick to you. Sister, you had your hand up. Depends on which book it was.
It was the purple of the blue book. You showed the hadith book. And the first,
there were two books I mentioned. That was to do with the Ulumul Hadith.
Yes.
There were books by Professor Muhammad Mustafa Al-A'dami.
And which one was the other one?
They're both by him. There was a small one and a bigger one. They're on hadith. They're in English actually.
Yeah.
So you can benefit from them.
So we can use these books.
Those are not to do with Arba'in. Those books are only to do with my first session.
Okay. Because I feel like I'm not really writing everything.
Okay, that's so, all right.
So if I want to just get...
Then we hope and pray that the audiovisual will be available and you can listen to it and start writing from there, inshallah. So it is being recorded, inshallah.
Like the names I'm writing down, maybe.
Yes, you can make mistakes with that. So ask me at the end if you've got things like, you've just asked me about the books and the name of the author. You can ask me things like that at the end. Other stuff with more detail, the names you come across, it's difficult to take them all in. But I pray and hope that we do a better job in making the audiovisual available quicker to you this time than we did with the Fiqh Sira, which, by the way, inshallah, should be coming out very soon as well. It started the process with uploading the Fiqh Sira onto YouTube. We started more seriously with that process a couple of months ago, but that should be imminent, inshallah. But we'll let you know as soon as they're out for you to access that as well. Now, we were on Imam An-Nawawi. Subhanallah. So, I said that he was of meager means. He wasn't into a lavish kind of living. Beyond that, what else can we say? If you read his tarjuma or his biography, various people have written about it. Somebody did a thesis on it as well, called Al-Haddad. And he mentions more detail about it, about his run-ins with the political powers. Yes, his disagreements with the political powers. When I look at that, quite honestly, I don't come up with a clear conclusion because you don't get the full picture of what the reason is of the running with the political powers. One of the stories, for example, is that the leader of the Muslim Ummah is wanting to fight the Mongols, and Nawawi is at the time when the Mongols are on one side attacking the Muslim Empire and the Crusades on the other side. Yeah. So his time, in fact, is just after Salahuddin, but the Crusades are still around. They haven't been completely eradicated from the Sham. They get eradicated after the death of An-Nawawi, in fact, towards the end of the 7th century. And the Mongols are certainly around. The Mongols have a defeat in the Sham, the famous Battle of Ain Jalut, which is the defeat by the Muslim powers in 658. So that's during the lifetime of Imam Nawawi, 658, because he's born in 631 Hijra. So Ain Jalut is the big battle in the Sham when the Mongols come from Aleppo, etc., near Jerusalem, and they are defeated by the Muslim Empire. And then the defeats for the Mongols start one after the other after that, because before that they sack Baghdad. Yeah, that's already happened, etc. So the Mongols are in grip. So one of the stories mentioned about the political powers trying to harness through taxes in the Sham, taxes on the Muslim Ummah. Why? To provide military assistance to fight off the Mongols. And Imam Nawawi's disagreement with the political power, yeah, because the people find it difficult with the taxes. So that's all it mentions, you know. But what it's trying to show, he had the he had the backbone to stand and speak the truth. That's what it's trying to show in the story. I don't know the details. Perhaps the political power was right and he was wrong. Allahu alam. Yeah, when you got the Mongols at the doorstep, yeah, what are you expecting to do? He wants to defeat the Mongols, because otherwise they'll ransack the Sham as they ransacked Baghdad and destroyed everything there already. So all those things, I don't know. I don't know the full story. But what we do get from that is that Imam An-Nawawi had the backbone to speak the truth, to stand for justice, certainly how he saw it at his time. We don't know the full details. Allah only knows the full story. As in many historical things, you know, I mean, even history anywhere, when you read about the Tudors and what was happening in the royal family of Britain, and she did that, and he did this, and that's why this happened. Allahu alam, who's writing the story? Who's writing it? And did they have all the information? Who's telling them? Somebody could be lying and it's being written. Don't people lie? Of course they do. So history, when it comes to these kind of things, I always take it with a big pinch of salt. Okay? Now, what else do I want to mention? I've already mentioned about his most famous work as Al-Majmu'a, yeah, about Shafi'i fiqh. And he did other writings to do with Shafi'i fiqh as well. Another great work of Imam Shafi'i is his Sharh of Sahih Muslim. Al-Minhaj, as he called it, fi sharhi Sahih Muslim Ibn al-Hajjaj. That, and sharh we use, you tend to use the word tafsir for Quran, and ulama tend to use the word tashrih or sharh, which has the same meaning, but for hadith instead. So Sahih Muslim, the most famous work for the explanation ahadith in the whole of Sahih Muslim, is the work of Imam An-Nawawi. Till this day. Yeah? It's of great standing. Okay? On par with the most famous work of Sahih al-Bukhari is by who?
Ibn Hajar.
Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. So these are the two works, the most famous works for the hadith compilation, and its tashrih is Sahih Muslim is an-Nawawi. For Sahih Bukhari, it is Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani who did Fath al-Bari. Fath al-Bari, interestingly, is the work originally of Imam Nawawi. Imam Nawawi came before Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. Okay? So Imam Nawawi actually started Fath al-Bari by the same name of his Sharh of Sahih al-Bukhari. But he didn't complete much of it before he died. So Ibn Hajar, out of respect from Imam Nawawi, when he did it, he called it by the same name. By the same name that Imam Nawawi has actually started the Sharh of Sahih Bukhari. So Fath al-Bari actually originally is started by Imam Nawawi, which he only did...
Imam Nawawi was doing, wrote a, was it a critique of Muslim Sahih?
Not critique, explanation, you could say, tafsir,
of
Sahih Muslim. Muslim, he's done that, yeah. Okay. And he did it also, he began it, of Sahih al-Bukhari as well, but he only did a small amount of it before he passed away. So the main one, done Fath al-Bari, as it's known as, of the deep explanation of Sahih al-Bukhari is by Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. Imam Nawawi's other famous work that you may have come across, because it's translated in English, is Riyad al-Salihin. Anybody come across that? Yeah. It's very good. It's very good. Because here, Imam Nawawi decided to put topics. He goes into legal rulings as well, but a lot of it's to do with good character. Yeah? So here he starts with Quranic ayat, then a hadith. Okay? Especially using Bukhari Muslim, but others as well. Yeah? On each section, that's what you'll find. And as other scholars who are critics of hadith said, it is brilliant, this Riyad al-Salihin, or the Gardens for the Righteous, as it's called. It's brilliant because the other critics, as they found out of all the hadith that he used in this compendium, perhaps only 30 or 40 are weak. The rest are all authentic. Yeah? So that's the difficulty you run into it is because it still goes into legal matters. So just he just gives the ahadith, but you can be left with, you know, is this the right, is not. But generally on akhlaq and character, it's very good for that. Yeah? Or being truthful, not being involved in backbiting, not undermining, you know, all this kind of thing. Being sincere, being neighborly, yeah? All this kind of thing is very good for that. So I found it useful in the early years, 20 odd years, I used to use that chapters from it especially, and you can build on that with an explanation, etc. as well. So that's a famous work of his. And of course, amongst the most famous work is his Arba'in and Nawawi, the 40 hadith of Nawawi. This 40 hadith and Nawawi, that he compiled, well, actually it's 42, yeah. But we'll come to discuss Arba'in. When they say Arba'in, and we'll see on what basis he did it, but generally when they say Arba'in, they don't necessarily mean exactly Arba'in, exactly 40. Yeah. It can be used like approximately 40, he decided to put 42 in his collection.
So Arba'in
means 40. Yeah. That's why it's known 40 hadith in English translation, 40 hadith of An-Nawawi. Actually, it's 42 hadith of An-Nawawi. Yeah, but that's how it's generally used. You know, it's used in a loose kind of sense, not to be exact in that regard. And often in language, in Arabic language, that's how it, you know, it's like approximately 40. Yeah? And when they say 70, or when they say 70,000, they don't mean exactly 70. They mean several many tens, right? And when they say 70,000, they mean many tens of thousands. Not to be precise, that's how it's used in language. Arabic used in that sense. The famous sharh, again, the word sharh is an explanation of those ahadith, are two or three. One by Ibn Daqiq al-Aid. His was an explanation. Ibn Daqiq al-Aid came shortly after him. He died in 702 Hijra, Ibn Daqiq al-Aid. Muhammad ibn Ali. He did explanation of the ahadith of Imam Nawawi. And it's not a detailed analysis, it's a short explanation. So if you want to, and actually interestingly, I just discovered it on my shelf today, I didn't realize, it's actually translated in English, this one, Ibn Daqiq al-Aid's sharh, or explanation of those 42 hadith of Nawawi is translated in English as well. So 40 hadith of Ibn Daqiq al-Aid, if you look for it, you'll find it in English as well. Ibn Daqiq al-Aid, he took this name, his name is Muhammad ibn Ali, but he took this Ibn Daqiq al-Aid from his great-grandparents, it seems, grandfather, it seems. So he's around the same time as Imam Nawawi. The other most famous deep explanation of the hadith of Imam Nawawi is called Al-Jami Al-Alum Wal-Hikam Fi Sharhi Khamsin Hadithan Min Jawami Al-Kalim. And that is done by Ibn Rajab. Ibn Rajab is the great Hanbali scholar, Zainuddin, who came over 100 years after Imam Nawawi. And his work, Al-Jawami Al-Ulum Wal-Hikam, the compendium on the science and wisdom, that's what he called it, in the explanation of 50 hadith from Jawami al-Kalim. Jawami al-Kalim is referring to the Prophet ﷺ, from the Prophet ﷺ, Jawami al-Kalim. We'll come to what Jawami al-Kalim means in the next lesson, inshallah. This is the most famous, it is described by many scholars as a brilliant work, a brilliant encyclopedic compendium. He takes the 42 hadith of Imam Nawawi, gives deep explanation to each one of them, including a deep explanation of the introduction, the Muqaddimah, by Imam Nawawi. And then he adds 8 hadith, which he chose himself, Ibn Rajab himself, to the 42 and makes 50 hadith. Okay? So it's the 42 hadith of Imam Nawawi, their deep explanation, plus 8 more that Ibn Rajab adds from himself, from the Prophet ﷺ, and therefore this is known as Jawami al-Ulum wal-Hikam. Okay, very famous work of Ibn Rajab, who is Hanbali. Okay? He wasn't Shafi'i, he's Hanbali in his madhab, but of course he had great respect and also influence of Imam Nawawi. Just to finish, before I finish, this is final thing. Yeah, sorry, a mistake I mentioned earlier. I said Imam Nawawi called his sharh, which he started with Imam Bukhari, as Fathul Bari. It wasn't Imam Nawawi. Imam Nawawi did start an explanation of deeper explanation of Sahih al-Bukhari, but he didn't call it Fath al-Bari. It was Ibn Rajab who did that. Ibn Rajab. Although Imam Nawawi did start an explanation of Imam Bukhari's Sahih, he didn't complete it. We don't know. I don't know what it was called. But Ibn Rajab, the Hanbali scholar, he certainly also did Fath al-Bari, and he did about a sixth of it. And then came Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, who 20 years later after him, and did Fathul Bari. So that's just a correction in that regard. So when I come to doing the explanation, a deep analysis of these hadith, I will be referring to Ibn Daqiq al-A'id, Ibn Rajab al-Hanbalis, Jawami al-Ulum al-Hikam, also aside from adding what's relevant from myself in the present day context and what I've learned and critiquing what the others have said. And also in English there's a very good work by Zarabozo. It's three volumes on the 42 hadith of Imam Nawawi. Yeah, he himself bases it on those works that I've mentioned. Okay, he himself bases it on those works I've mentioned of Ibn Rajab, Ibn Daqiq al-A'id, and his own explanation. So I'll be using that, those other two books, and my own input when I'm going to be presenting, inshallah, the ahadith. Next time, we will carry on, and we will start looking at analyzing first, from Arabic, the actual muqaddimah of Imam Nawawi. What he gave as an introduction before he put these 42 hadith together. And in that, there are lots of lessons, inshallah. Beyond that, I think the lesson after that, we will look at the idea of da'if hadith. And I think the lesson after that, we'll probably get on to the first hadith. أَقُولُ قَوْلِ هَذَا وَاسْتَغْفِرُ لِي وَلَكُمْ إِنَّهُ غَفُورٌ رَحِيمٌ. Any final question before we stop for Adhan? Yep. Yes. If you just look for 40 hadith,
yes.
Yeah, yes. Sharh and put Ibn Daqiq al-Eid,
yes.
You'll find it.
Oh, exactly.
Sharh al-Nawawi, Sharh al-Ra'in. Yes, Adhan, thanks.